to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on your cable dial, and you know we're heard around the world in Shoutcast at cfuv.uvic.ca. Well, last week, Israeli prisoner of war Gilad Shalit was released in exchange for more than 1,000 Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Shalit was an army sergeant captured over 5 years ago in a night raid of a Gaza outpost. The Palestinians released were portrayed in the Israeli media to a man, woman, and child as vile murderers, though public opinion there strongly favored the prisoner swap. While not all those promised release have made it home yet, and many won't, exile being the price of their freedom, but remaining behind in Israeli prisons are thousands more who live in conditions rarely revealed to the outside world. Elmer is a Canadian journalist and photographer living in and reporting from occupied Palestine. Elmer has spent the better part of the last decade filing for the Interpress Service and Al Jazeera English and various online publications. He is also the author of the website johnelmer.ca. John Elmer in the first half. And the People's Assembly convergence last week at Victoria's Centennial Square has continued in the form of a tented encampment in the heart of the city. I went down there yesterday and spoke with Mike, a volunteer at the media liaison tent, to get a feel for what's happening down there and what's the movement's manifestation here means. Mike and messages from Victoria's front line of the growing global movement for economic and social justice in the second half. And Victoria Street News publisher and CFUV broadcaster Janine Bancroft will join us at the bottom of the hour to keep us current with some of the goings-on going on our city streets and beyond. But first, John Elmer on prisoners released and not released in the Middle East. Stick around. Welcome back to the program, John.
Thanks again, Chris.
Well, now, John, we saw some of the coverage from Israel last week. Has this jubilation of this massive prisoner release died down in the occupied territories yet, or are they still celebrating?
No, I mean, people are still celebrating. It's difficult to really to understand how comprehensive the prisoner issue is in Palestine. The fact that the number released in this latest exchange is something that impacts, you know, quite literally every family in the West Bank and Gaza knows somebody that was involved in that exchange or somebody that will be involved in the completion of the Shalit exchange, which will happen in the next several weeks with the rest of the 1,000 prisoners, about half of the 1,000 prisoners released. So, you know, it's something that in the West Bank and Gaza, more than three-quarters of a million people have been incarcerated since the occupation regime began in 1967, and that's in a population that is only today 3.5 million people. So it's really, you know, gobstopping numbers that the have in prison. So it's at the core of the conflict, and I think that the release that this Shalit release is something that will have reverberations within the West Bank and Gaza and within the Israel-Palestine conflict for quite some time to come.
Well, now, I know that you're back in Canada now, but last week, the day after this release, was listening to the CBC radio in the morning, my favorite, Anna Maria Tremonti, and she dutifully described each and every one of the Palestinians released, as I said in the intro, as she didn't use the word vile murderers as much of the Israeli press has, but she characterized them all as murderers and terrorists. Shall we take the CBC and Anna Maria Tremonti seriously in this report, or frankly in anything that they have to say about Israel-Palestine?
Well, as is often the case, it's the omission that that is often the most important element. So while there are hundreds of the prisoners that are being released were involved in the armed struggle against Israel. There's no question about that. None of them would deny that. But the reality of the matter is that the Israeli soldier was a tank gunner stationed on the Gaza border, shelling the Gaza Strip for the 3 weeks previous. So I think that one of the most important things to remember about the CDC coverage was that I think more than any other tank gunner in the history of conflict, the Shalit was personalized and humanized. His family struggled, the struggle of Israelis as they watched their captive son, their single captive son, I think is probably legitimate. I'm not denying the authenticity of that sentiment. In fact, I think it's a very authentic feeling, and it should be something that should be applied to Palestinians quite literally 5,000 times over for this one soldier, because even after this exchange is complete, there will still be more than 5,000 Palestinians incarcerated, many of them for multiple life sentences, and their prospects of being released, as the entire 20-year peace process has shown us, is that they're outside of the diplomatic process. The prisoner release, I mean, I think the most important underlining element of this prisoner all around is that 20 years of diplomacy wasn't able to capture quite literally a fraction of the movement on the Palestinian prisoner issue as one single cross-border operation in 2006 was able to do. And I think that's something that's quite clear within the West Bank. I mean, the stories—it's really hard to humanize fully the importance of this release. But you know, looking through with my friends in Bethlehem at the list as they started to leak out which prisoners were on the list, quite literally looking through handwritten names, because who of the 5,000, 6,000 prisoners were going to be released is an enormous story all throughout the West Bank and Gaza. In fact, all throughout the Palestinian diaspora all over the world, it was a huge story. And something I think that, you know, we need to remember what it was that precipitated this, because in the disengagement, as it was called, from Gaza, Israel's withdrawal from Gaza, they left and locked up the Gaza Strip, removed their forces the inside of Gaza, situated them on the outside of Gaza, and had for a year and a half before Shalit was captured, taken prisoner, had been consistently shelling the border day by day. Nothing had changed for the Palestinian political aspirations with the you know, the so-called disengagement, the withdrawal of Israeli soldiers and settlers from Gaza. That had not done anything, as the Oslo peace process before it had done nothing to free the more than 6,000 Palestinian political prisoners, expressly political prisoners, in prison in Israel. So it was a moment of authentic joy and personal agency that's rare for Palestinians in a conflict that's so often mediated by third parties.
Well, Uri Avneri from Gush Shalom, he had an article this week where he says he's been watching. He lives in Israel. He is an Israeli Jew. He was saying, well, some smart alecky television interviewer asked a 5-year-old Israeli child why he thought that they had handed over 1,000 Palestinians for just one Israeli, and fully, as Avneri describes, expecting to hear the child say, well, because, you know, Israelis are worth 1,000 times more. And this 5-year-old simply looked at this at his interrogator and said, because we've taken so many more prisoners than they have, and they've only taken one prisoner.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you rely on the children for lucidity on both sides of the conflict in many cases. I mean, it's quite clear to the Palestinians the role that on the others, you know, children on the other side, it's quite clear to them as well. And that's, I think, one of the interesting things that you're saying about CBC. It takes a real, you know, systemic effort to remove from the story the context of the prisoners themselves. And you see something like, you know, 5-year-old children on either side of the conflict being able to more lucidly explain the humanitarian, you know, the human interest element, the political element to the story. You know, 5- and 6-year-olds are able to handle it more capably than most of the important CBC talent on the national broadcaster. You know, the number of times they framed the story on CBC through Shalit, there wasn't one time when the story was reversed. And so that's something that's a structural bias that the CBC presents without really ever being confronted. And again, it's not necessarily what CBC says. It's what they don't say that's the most important element to the story.
Well, as you said, omission can sometimes tell you a lot more than commission. And of all these prisoners released, as you say, there's many more that are not being released, and ones that aren't so easily typified, but as terrorists and murderers, as Anna Maria and her solely Israeli guests on the program I listened to, at least, opined on. There was another Israeli journalist, Gideon Levite. He's talked about, well, you know, maybe this release wasn't handled well. Maybe there was some accidents. Maybe this is going to empower Hamas politically at the cost of Abu Mazen or the president, I use the word loosely, Abbas. Do you think that was, it seems certainly that is going to be the effect, but do you think, as Gideon Levy seems to say, that was accidental or unintended consequence, or is Israel up to a bit of a game here to undermine Abbas?
No, I think one of the things that caused the whole so long, I mean, effectively the number 7-1, all of the women and all of the children, was the basic framework of the exchange from day one that Hamas offered going back to 2006. So there's really no reason to believe that there's any reason why Israel didn't negotiate up until now. I mean, one of the primary reasons, I should say, simply because it would be such a boon to Hamas. And there's no doubt about it. There's no question in any mind anywhere seriously studying the conflict that Hamas won, this exchange. That's the case for the Palestinian people. It's definitely the case for Mahmoud Abbas. There's no doubt about it. Abbas's tactics of negotiation, collaboration, lying effectively down for any Israeli and American dictate has released precisely zero prisoners. And these people aren't abstractions. These are family members of the Palestinian political community. Not only family members, they're the heroes. I mean, we heard that Shalit was a hero. We heard that Shalit was courageous. This is somebody that's inside a tank backed by one of the largest armies in the world. So if he's a hero and he's courageous, what of the Palestinian fighters who were released of prison, released from prison for? I mean, frankly, look, just as Shalit didn't hand out puppies and flowers in Gaza, many of the Palestinians that were released from prison in this prisoner exchange weren't releasing puppies in Israel either. These were hardcore, in many cases, members of the armed struggle. As one of them said, we're just soldiers going back to our bases. And that's how they see it. These people aren't, they're fighters for their national cause, and there's no, there's no equivocation about that whatsoever. And that's why it was important to pick the right moment, both for Israel and for the United States and for Hamas as well. I mean, Hamas's popularity right now is waning. Their ability to effectively create governance to end the siege on Gaza, those things had not been working. Locally, they were not as popular as they have been. And they themselves, in many cases, have renounced the armed struggle. In fact, you could argue that the last military operation that Hamas embarked on was the Shalit 5 years ago. So they themselves needed a boost, and there's no doubt, as far as Israel is concerned, that Hamas would get that boost, and picking the right moment to hand that coup to their enemies was something that was really important for Israel. There's no doubt about it. And it does weaken Abbas significantly, and you can see that today. The IDF, the head of the IDF is suggesting that Israel release as a goodwill gesture to Abbas, a bunch of Fatah prisoners. And so if that doesn't tell you how Israel sees the exchange, probably nothing will.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable, and cfuv.uvic.ca everywhere else on the internet. I'm speaking tonight with John Elmer, and John is a freelance journalist and photojournalist who spends most of his time within occupied Palestine, now back in his home country, Canada, our home and native land. And how is it, John, coming back to the home and native land? And I mean, you know, because we're both pretty much press-oriented, looking at the way not only the Canadian press looks at Israel-Palestine, but on the whole region, we've seen Canada become entangled past Afghanistan, now in Libya. What's your impression, having lived in the region and gotten your information from afar, then coming back and seeing what's presented to Canadians as facts on the ground, so to speak?
Well, I've always said that the culture shock for me is not going and living in the Middle East, but actually coming back to Canada, and the starkness of how you see. So, for example, when I'm abroad, I consume CBC, but only flagship programs, not the hour-by-hour stuff when I come home. The quality, the context, the seriousness, the sophistication of Canada's media, every single time I come home, as you say, I go often half a year between being in Canada, and so it is easier to see with the time away the changes that are undergoing. You know, the dumbing down of the CBC, the tabloid nature of the Globe and Mail. I mean, all of this stuff is very stark when you're away from it on a day-by-day basis and come back to it. Of course, I mean, I consume the media when I'm away, but to see it in a blow-by-blow, day-by-day when you're home makes it really quite stark. And, you know, the fact that the Middle East Bureau, the Jerusalem Bureau of the CBC has been all but a skeleton staff. They've stopped covering the story, which is why they had to, for the Shalit deal, rely so much on Israel, because their correspondents are so disconnected at this point from the West Bank and Gaza that they can't effectively work there. They can't cover that story. And that's quite clear when you come back. And you know, just the general dumbing down of our information sources, which, of course, as you said, we all know. I'm sure listeners to your program are listening to your program most likely for that reason, so there's no sense in putting too fine a point on something that's obvious, but it is stark, and as I say, my culture shock is returning. It's actually not going.
Well, something that has changed as well in this country since you were here last is this occupation movement, the People's Assemblies, as it's called here in Victoria, and I think that name might pick up in other places as well. And of course, this is inspired at least by what happened in the Middle East in the so-called Arab Spring. I know that you like to stay, fairly close to your main subject, which is Israel-Palestine, but, I mean, can I get you to venture a little further along the continuum of the arc of instability here and get your thinking on what happened in Libya last week and has been happening in Libya for the last 6 months or so?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was quite clear too, right? I mean, I think coming back and seeing the type of coverage that surrounded the last days of Gaddafi were interesting. You know, the first day after Gaddafi's, he was basically lynched. I don't know really what else to say. Slowly killed as Canadian commentators effectively cheered it on, which was, I think at least somewhat authentic to the coverage all the way along. We didn't hear a lot about Canada's role in Libya, though it was a pretty important role. Canadian forces took part in more than 10% of the actual operations. They were a Canadian forces general quite specifically appointed as NATO commander of the overall mission. Of course, Canada's role in Libya began weeks before the war, as we probably discussed on your program. Harper dispatched warships in a show of force 3 weeks before the NATO, before the resolution on Libya itself. So it was very much a Canadian war, very much a European war as well, and quite expressly a war for oil. I think something that's very interesting to note is Canada's business interests were the first ones over into Libya. The first trips for Suncor and for SNC-Lavalin, which is tellingly, SNC-Lavalin had been building prisons for Gaddafi, you know, the brutal prisons that the CBC told us all about but never told us were built by SNC-Lavalin, are now being built for the rebel government, NATO's rebels. And that's the kind of sort of business stability that we see. Gaddafi sort of ran out, usefulness ran out, his interests and Western oil companies' interests no longer lapped significantly enough, so it was time to do away with him. Canada plays a key role in the diplomatic aspect, in the military aspect, and now is the first ones back on the ground, making sure the oil starts flowing again, quite literally the day after Tripoli falls, and quite literally the day after the declaration of liberation of Libya. It's very much a Canadian operation from the first days, and I think that when you couple the role of the Canadian forces in that war and then with the pathetic coverage of the CBC, you start to get collaboration that starts to show some of these connections between media, big business, military, and the type of reactions that they've garnered with the what we've seen with the early stages, at least, of the Occupy movement. Many of these themes are devastatingly overlapping, and I think that that's something that has become clearer to people that aren't necessarily political, wouldn't call themselves political activists. And I think that's one damning statement about how deep the cuts have come is that the Occupy movements show that it's not activists that are involved, and for the first time in our broad-based social movements, it looks like we have crossing class lines in many cases, as we saw with things like airline pilots and people like that we would never have expected to join a, let's say, leftist activist social protest.
Yeah, well, this country is changing fast. I mean, outlawing union actions, as with the airline pilots at Air Canada and the rest of the Air Canada staff that have valid grievances, and the militarization of our society. $35 billion announced in naval contracts. I'm not sure who our Navy is going, with this brand new Navy is going to engage, but it certainly it militarizes the economy and the government spending in this country. It makes us look a little bit more like our cousins south every day. Well, John, we don't have a lot of time, but there's a lot going on, of course, in and around the Middle East neighborhood with Qaddafi. I was speaking to an Iranian friend of mine today who is very politically astute and said, well, Qaddafi was demonized before, the actual weapons started falling and in the United Nations, and they had criminal warrants sworn out against him, whereas in Yemen, Ali's has been given immunity from the Security Council from prosecution, to give him a way to step aside and for the next replacement. How do you... When I mentioned the arc of instability, John, I mean, is this a pattern now? I mean, Libya, Yemen, now Syria, it seems, and of course, all leading towards the plum on top of it all, Iran. Is this all part of a concerted effort, and as my friend suggested, part of the Zionist plan or this arc of instability to destabilize the entire region?
Well, I think in the Libya basis, you have, I think if we look back at that moment, I think it's important to see Libya as a way for, both for, the Arab uprisings to affect economic interests, in the other places that they took place, Tunisia and Egypt, in large examples, they were political in the case of Egypt, but, less economic interests, but the possibility of throwing Libya, a major supplier of European oil into chaos was in nobody's interest. And for the, Western alliance, American-Israeli alliance, to watch the Arab Spring define, at that point, the agenda completely defined by the streets, I think Libya provided an important foothold on the Arab Spring, even just the narrative for the Israeli and Western power. look at the situation, I mean, the Arab uprisings have done very little for Israel. If you look, even the truncated uprising in Egypt has created a paradigm for Israel, which is, I think, frankly, and I know from being there, something that has, you know, Israelis from the top of the government all the way down, you know, through the population, quite concerned. If we look at the attack that happened in Eilat a couple of months ago, that attack, you know, on Israel's undefended southern border is the kind of thing that Israel has been able to avoid for the past, you know, 25, 30 years because of Egypt's protection. And so to have the uprisings casting such doubt on the situation, I mean, even in Syria, the benefit for Israel of a revolution in Syria is questionable. Assad, no friend of Israel's on the outside, has been internally very important for Israeli stability throughout the last 20 years. And you could look at the Nakba Day demonstrations that were commemorating the ethnic cleansing from Palestine that we talked about back in May. Those demonstrations flooding Israel's northern border were something that were new, simply because for the first time in 25 years, the Syrian regime allowed that to happen. So I don't think necessarily that you can say there's an Israeli-American conspiracy in these uprisings other than to attempt to defend their interest in the face of something that really casts doubt on Israel's long-term viability. And I think that's something that's very important to note. The uprisings and the current context for Israel post invasion of Gaza 2008-2009, if you will, Israel's at its weakest point that it's ever been. And I think that, you know, even as I said, the uprising in Egypt has been truncated, I think, at this point. Yet still, there's no benefit to Israel for, you know, people attacking their embassies. You know, there's a real popular ill will, I mean, naturally, towards Israel in the region. And it was the dictators, it was the Assads and Mubaraks, rather than using Israel as an outlet, as, you know, some Western commentators suggest. In fact, it was them that kept the demonstrations against Israel under wraps for the past 20 years. So I think that they're, you know, a bit of an overstatement of this Arab Spring, as if it has a common impetus or even features that are similar in each of the countries. But I think in general, the trend itself is something that doesn't benefit in any way Israel right now.
Well, as the proverbial Chinese say, may you live in interesting times, and we certainly do. And I'm glad that we have you, John, on the spot in that most interesting part of the world to keep us abreast of the real news, the real situation on the street as it is, and being so lacking of real media as we are here in Canada. Thanks a lot, John Elmer, for coming on the show again.
My pleasure as always, Chris. Thanks.
All right. Till the next time then. I'm going to take a brief break now, but when I come back, I'm going to be joined by Janine, and she's going to bring us up to speed with some of the things going on in and around our city. So do stick around for that. And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio, CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable, cfuv.uv.ca everywhere else. Joining me now, as oft times she does, is Janine Bancroft. Hey, Janine.
Hey, Chris. Well, I guess the big news around town is the People's Assembly of Victoria. Mm-hmm. And you spent a little time there yourself, did you?
I went down there. As I mentioned in the intro, I went down there over the weekend. I didn't spend a lot of time there. You know, sort of hung around for a little bit and talked to a very well-spoken fellow, Mike, who was at the media tent. Because there was like 50 tents, like people living tents set up in and around the square. All in the square, and then these other tents, you know, like support tents, bigger things, and one of them was a media tent, and there was a big food thing set up, and then a live stage. You know, it's quite the little community.
It is, and it's really interesting watching it evolve. Every time I go, there's something new. They have a little meditation corner set up now, and they've got a library and a sort of area under the cover. It's kind of cool how they've got, you know, they do have some cover. It's unfortunate they're on this. They do have some protection from the rain, and they had couches and actually a pull-down screen, I guess, so they could do sort of presentations. And it's really evolving nicely. It's also starting to attract some of the street community who I don't know, you know, for sure. It is sort of in the red zone, so some people might be cautious about going there, especially because there are police and that sort of thing. But I did run into some of the street community there, especially because they're offering two free meals a day. So that's definitely going to attract people, and that's great because, you know, that's a big part of what it's about, I think. And I'm not sure, you know, how many cities are realizing that. So, you know, getting the homeless involved, getting the indigenous communities involved, anything that people can do to make it as inclusive as possible, I think is really great. And I think in Victoria they're totally doing that. David Johnston is there. He was arrested last week on the first time he tried to go there because of outstanding court injunctions that he's got because of his constant battle with the city and the province and the Charter of Canadian Rights and Freedoms that say we have the right to protect ourselves, or sorry, the right to life, liberty, and security of person. And he truly believes, as I do, that, you know, sleep is an imperative, and the lack of sleep, denying people the ability to sleep, is a form of torture. And so he's taken on this struggle, and it's been years. And I think at this point, it's just sort of a battle of wills, you know. The city has invested so much in trying to keep this bylaw in place, so that they can police the homeless, that they're you know, it's very difficult for them to acknowledge anything different. So a lot of campers were concerned that the police might go down and arrest them, but it's really diabolical, I think is a word I would use to watch what they're doing. They did arrest David, and they kept him overnight, and I think two nights, and then they let him go again. And he is actually camping there. They haven't moved in to arrest him again, and he feels like he's safe for the time being. Because what they're planning, people may have heard that they, on the one, the mayor came out with an announcement sort of saying he supports the protest, and because it's different from what David Johnston was trying to do, which was appropriate public lands for use, which you know, is a really loaded statement considering we're all on stolen native land. But then in the next breath he said, oh, and by the way, we're going to be flooding the area for a skating rink this winter for the kiddies. And I've lived in this town for 21 years. There's never been a skating rink at Centennial Square. So this is a really interesting divide and conquer tactic, I think, that, you know, when the time comes and they're going to want to put the lights on the sequoia tree and they're going to want to build the skating rink for the kiddies, and they'll just be able to say, well, look at these dirty hippies are in the way. We're going to have to get them to move, you know. So, and then talking to some of the campers, it's a reflection of my own ideological youth, you know, when you really held out for the best in people and you really thought that people were good-hearted. And some of the responses that I'm getting on Facebook about my concern about what's going to come down in a couple of weeks is that, oh, no, it's okay, because we'll be able to, you know, the people will bring their kids skating and we'll be able to interact with them and show them the camp and maybe they'll join us. And I'm just like, yeah, okay, you're young and you haven't seen what I've seen. I'm getting old and jaded somewhat, Chris. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I mean, about the old and jaded part, yeah, I think I'm a step ahead of you there. But then again, you know, I wouldn't have thought that even we would have gotten this far. You were in Vancouver. I mean, there's another assembly in Vancouver, and then people are staying there as well. But the mayor has come out and said, okay, well, we're, you know, this is costing us, just as the same press release, I think, in from New York City, was, okay, well, this is costing us extra money for policing. This is, you know, like I think they mentioned, it was $500,000 they've spent other, you know, on policing that they wouldn't have otherwise spent, which I think is, I don't know how they quantify that, but, you know, and so the mayor there is sort of saying, well, you know, it's hinting that, you know, their time is running out.
Right, right. Well, interestingly, you know, remember in Washington, D.C., those folks got a four-month permit to be on federal lands camping in D.C. And then I just found a news story from Albany, New York, where state troopers and Albany police refused a curfew crackdown on protesters that was urged by their governor and the Albany mayor. And they said the bottom line is the police, no policing, not the governor and not the mayor. And they didn't feel that moving in on 700 protesters and beginning a mass arrest was going to be in any way useful when the people were peacefully protesting. So, you know, we're seeing little acts of rebellion in other cities, and perhaps our own police will follow suit, although we have Jamie Graham at the helm, so, you know, anything could happen. But meanwhile, you know, the camp is very welcoming. It's a very comfortable place to be. If people are concerned, you know, there is security and there are police there. If you're afraid of the protesters, go and see what it is for yourself. Don't take it from us. On Wednesday, there's an interesting activity there. The Transition Victoria people are holding a gift circle, and the idea of a gift circle is it's sort of like barter, but not. Like, barter is where you exchange goods, you agree on a fair exchange. A gift economy is where you just find out what people need, and it's gifted. You end up gifting or receiving without any reciprocity. It comes from other places, right? It's a larger sort of barter. So that's happening on Wednesday from 7:30 to 9:30 at Centennial Square.
Well, if nothing else, it'll get people acquainted with a public space that, in my view, is often underutilized. I mean, we go there, you know, for summer concerts and for various rallies, but a lot of the time, you know, the people, you know, don't really see, you know, it being employed by a great cross section of the population as you are now. Well, Janine, there's a lot more to talk about, but we don't have a lot of time. We don't have any time, in fact. But I do have time to say that your program, Alternating Thursdays, The Winds of Change, 11 a.m. right here at CFUV. You're on this week, I understand, right?
Yes, I am, and I'll have guests from the assembly.
Okay, great. And of course, the Street News for November, the Street News, Victoria Street News newspaper, which you were the publisher of these last, what, almost 7 years now?
Seven and a half years.
Oh my word. Okay, well, it's on the streets as well, so go and support the Victoria Street News and get another view of things. Yeah. Now, as I said, I went and talked to this guy Mike. I'm going to play a bit of music first, and then I'll go to that interview with him. And thanks a lot, Janine. I'll talk to you the next time, eh?
Thank you, Chris.
All right, bye-bye.
Dramavu na mavu y'umuhanzi Popo muri Uganda. Navukiye mu Burundi gataraka Kayanza urira mu ngagara Bujumbura Data ni muri gande babukuzagara gakanyamibwa karukika munzi waseka ryuguri kasekabota sekabota kamugarura garura wakanyamuhungu Kangira shamba abatobe babiru
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio, CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 cable, and cfuv.uvic.ca on the internet. Behind me there is Mighty Popo. This is a new disc here in our library. The album is called Gekondo. I might be pronouncing that correctly, but I wouldn't count on it. He's a Rwandan dude, but a Canadian now. That's pretty cool. Well, as I said before the break there, over the weekend, I went down to the People's Assembly, the leftovers of the convergence of last week's big march and rally at Victoria Centennial Square. There's a tent encampment there, and I went down and spoke with Mike, and he's a volunteer at the media liaison tent. And here's Mike setting me straight on what's going on down there.
messages that we see about environmental issues, about human rights issues, about wealth inequality, about banks, about corporate control of media and government, that variety of issues is because the problems that we've seen with capitalism recently are very diverse and very hard to sum up quickly. And there are lots of sort of consequences of our modern failing capitalist state. And due to that variety of consequences, you see people identifying a variety of consequences, and that's reasonable. I mean, like, I think people to look at, like, a wide variety of problems come from the way things are running. So that's sort of the wide variety of messages you see here. And the fact, the movement is very deliberately trying to be inclusive as many people and as many voices as possible. Historically, within political science and other social sciences, when you study social movements, what you often find is that social movements don't do a great job of including their own minorities. And if you want to talk to somebody about this extensively, speak with Matt James at the University of Victoria Poli Sci Department. He's an expert on social movements, and you should go talk to him. But as studied, social movements don't do a good job of respecting their own minorities historically. And this movement is trying to be more inclusive than that and doing its best to include all voices. And that's part of the movement to use the term People's Assembly of Victoria rather than Occupied Victoria, because Aboriginal activists rightly point out that this is already occupied land and that it's unceded territory.
Well, it's a touchy term, and not only for the First Nations, but also when you look at the occupations of Iraq and in Afghanistan and in Palestine, it has an entirely different meaning there again. But here, you know, a week after the Great March, this is, again, October 22nd, Saturday, remnants of 50-odd tents around here with people living in them, and many other infrastructure tents and a big food center, right in the shadow, literally, of Victoria City Hall. I see police walking around now, just having coffee, just walking through. It seems pretty casual. How has the reaction been by law enforcement and other officialdom here in the city over this last week?
It's been very good, very positive. I think that both City Hall and the police understand that, like, we're not trying to... we're not going to be disruptive, we're not going to destroy things, we're not dangerous people. And that really, like, this is just a movement about, like, raising issues with capitalism and getting fostering discussion about how we fix this sort of system. And as a result, both police and City Hall have been very friendly, very supportive. We've had Dean Fortin came to the square.
That's the mayor of Victoria.
Yeah, to talk to people, and has allowed us to keep hold of this space. And the police as well have decided that they won't be enforcing no camping during the day by law. And police have just been, like, very friendly. I've seen lots of conversations where police have just been smiling and talking with members of the movement, drinking coffee, and just, like, they know that we don't see them, for the most part, like, the movement doesn't see them as enemies, but more as, like, people to work with, people to facilitate making sure that this is a positive thing, rather than some of the really harsh brutality that we've seen elsewhere, mainly in the States, but also in the rest of the world. Rome went bad, for example.
Well, you've just continued listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm here in the street in Centennial Square in Victoria, talking with Mike. Mike's with the Media Center here. And again, we're looking at the encampment of the People's Assembly. It started with the march here. This is in sympathy with the various Occupy movements in the United States and in Europe, as Mike mentioned. Well, and you also mentioned, Mike, the no camping bylaw. That's been a very controversial issue in Victoria over the last 4 or 5 years now. Are there people that we would term as homeless or unhoused that have come down and joined this movement? And when you say inclusiveness, is there a place for them? The people that are, this is not new to be camping or living out of doors.
Certainly we have seen some people who are unhoused come down and join and camp out. And frankly, I see that as a terrific thing. Like, these are people that have, like, fallen through the cracks of our current capitalist system.
Or been pushed through them.
Being pushed through them. these are people who, like, the system really clearly and really strongly hasn't been working for. So frankly, like, those are people that we very keenly and clearly want to include in the movement and want to make sure that they're around. And we want to know that we want their voices to be heard too, because those are people who have been really sort of probably unfairly treated in this system. And so I think it's great that we see some of these people come down and join us and camp out with us.
Well, here it is. It's October, late October. November is coming. It's a threat we could almost see on the western horizon of the city. It's raining now. Last Saturday when the march happened, it was beautiful weather. It was a lovely day, maybe unseasonably warm even. But now it looks like the season is more seasonable. How do you see the change of weather affecting what's going on here, and what about the health and sanitation, and, you know, being exposed like this, you know, maybe getting sick?
Yeah, in terms of health and sanitation, I know that the food committee is doing a good job in being very careful about that in relation to food. In terms of, like, staying warm and pouring rain, that's something that I expect will be a challenge for campers to deal with, and that what we'll see from the logistics team is increasing need of warm clothes, of places to do laundry. One of the local hotels has donated laundry services, so people...
Oh, which hotel?
I don't know the name off the top of my head, I'm afraid, but I was just reading about it the other day. And so we'll see increasing need logistically of things like tarps, things like warm clothes, and it's possible that some people will get discouraged by the weather. That being said, Victoria is in a much better place than lots of other places in Canada, and indeed there has been discussion about how to facilitate Victoria being a safe place and Victoria's movement continuing despite the winter that we're going to see coming. Like, everyone knows it's coming. It's something to work on. That being said, people are determined. We are all determined. This movement is something really strong, really great, and I fully expect it will continue for a while.
Well, and safety. Now, this will be the first weekend spent out of doors in the tent, in the tent encampment that here at the People's Assembly here. Has there been any sort of Yahoo kind of behavior, people coming down at night maybe out of the clubs and so forth and thinking that the dirty hippies, as you mentioned? Yeah. I mean, like, what are you guys doing down here? Is safety an issue in that regard?
I haven't heard of any problems thus far, truth be told, and I don't really expect it much. I mean, drunken people will always be drunken people, and whether or not there's people in the square doesn't really affect the numbers that go to the bars and then come out of the bars and do foolish things on the weekend. I truly doubt that it's going to, like, become a magnet for people leaving bars and become an unsafe space, mostly because I've been down here a few nights and it usually gets pretty quiet. Like, there's been a general consensus agreement to try to be quiet between the hours of 11 and 8 so that people can get a good night's sleep, and as a result, in the evenings it's pretty calm, and that prevents it from becoming this sort of second or, like, after bar party. Like, that's not the atmosphere we're going for, and it's pretty clear it's not the atmosphere being facilitated. And I think that, like, even random drunk people coming out of bars can tell that that's not what we're looking for here.
Well, now, after by the time this will air on Monday, the 24th of October, at this point, how do people listening, how do they offer up support if they feel they wish to support what's going on down here?
The best thing we can ask anyone to do is come down to the square, talk to people, get informed. If you come down at noon or 6, there will be food. We always want people to be down here in the square, talking to the people who are camping here, learning about the movement. Other avenues for support: the food committee is always taking donations. You can contact them at food@paov.ca. And there are other things that are needed, which you can find on our website.
What's POV?
People's Assembly of Victoria. PAOV.
PAOV,
yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. And So on our website at www.paov.ca, you can find a constantly updated list of things that campers need. But the thing we like most, and the thing I definitely like to see most, is more people down here. It's people coming down to talk to people.
Well, and you mentioned Food Not Bombs has been helping out there. Of course, all vegan. Is that a concern that if people are going to donate food or that they consider that something that everybody can eat and not everybody wants to eat meat products?
Yeah, meat, we prefer... I'm not a member of the food committee. I'm not volunteering with them. But my knowledge of most recent discussions is that meat and fish are particularly hard to keep, hard to prepare safely, and thus they're avoiding using them as much as possible. Non-perishables are preferred, things that aren't going to go bad as quickly.
Tinned and dried.
Yeah, for sure. As well as things like bread and fruit that'll last a few days and can be kept at, like, outdoor temperature without going bad.
Well, now, you mentioned that Dean Fortin, the mayor, and the city council and the police have all been very accommodating so far. I heard yesterday that in Vancouver, where there's a similar movement going on there, that the media seemed, and this was the CBC radio that I was listening to, they seemed to be leaning away from this, saying, well, now we're worried about the costs of policing. Is they having police come through as an extra cost somehow? I didn't quite get how that was, but there was a tone there that, okay, kids, enough is enough. It's time to go home.
Yeah.
Is there any sense of that maybe happening here, or...
Well, on our website, you can actually find a video with somebody from the Victoria Police Department talking about this particular issue. And what he revealed was that they're not spending any extra money and they're not sending any extra patrols down, aside from last Saturday during the march, where they had a few extra officers on. They're just using sort of like normal downtown patrols, normal running operations. Like, they're so unconcerned about this that...
Well, we're two blocks away from the police station. As well.
Yeah, like, they're not using extra resources in Victoria, and I think that's, like, the sort of thing that this movement should be doing. Like, we aren't a problem for the police, and just spending extra police money to, like, make sure we aren't a problem is kind of silly when we know we aren't a problem. Like, New York, they have spent $5 million on policing, but that's just a colossal mistake as far as I'm concerned, because all that extra policing has done very little aside from, like, reveal, like, really extreme cases of police brutality and galvanize the people to support Occupy Wall Street and really, like, come out against that waste of public funds.
Well, now, Mike, where do you see this going? Now, I know this is unfair, and I mean, one person can't have the answer, but where would you like to see this going? What would you like to see coming out of this? I mean, people aren't doing this just for the sake of doing it.
No. Well, I would love to see, like, ongoing holding of the square, and then every, like, 2 weeks or a month, like, another day of protest about one of the many issues that we see here. Renewed marches, renewed sort of, like, public celebration of our community voice and of participating in democracy and of making legislatures aware of the issues we want them to be dealing with. What I think, like, where I think this is going is sort of long-term use of the space means that public officials have to pay attention and public officials have to be aware of what's going on here. And thus, like, one of the main things that social movements do, using sort of like a traditional political science analysis here, is like set the agenda for debate in legislature. And the movement's not specifically about getting some resolution passed to address issues of wealth inequality and corporate control. Personally would like to see that sort of thing happen, and it's pretty clear that the movement is having some impact because, well, in the States, Obama has come out and said that, like, on his 2012 campaign trail, he will be addressing issues of corporate control politics, and he will be addressing issues of wealth inequality. And of course, whether that'll go far enough, whether he'll be successful, whether that's actually a sincere account is, of course, impossible to say.
No, hope springs eternal.
Yeah, hope springs eternal. And furthermore, the people have a clearer sense because of these discussions of what they want and what they want to see, and that simply means more informed voters. And that simply means if politicians don't address these issues, if politicians don't deal with what we want them to deal with, what we're going to see is votes turning against them. So hopefully, come Canada's next election, one of the parties will stand for this, and I know that the NDP party has been discussing that. Not that this movement is aligned with a specific party, but what we're just seeing is that public discourse is changing so that people are aware of these issues, and that fundamentally is an important thing for changing the way a democracy works and changing what sort of resolutions we see. And of course, that's all just my perspective. There's a pretty strong divide. I know the New York Times did a lengthy survey. They got 2,000 people, and of the respondents, 40% of respondents in New York said that democracy or capitalism needs to be fixed and regulated, and then 37% of respondents said that capitalism needed to be thrown out completely. And that's a strong divide within the movement, and I'm of the fix capitalism camp, but you might talk to the next person down the line who's of the throw out capitalism camp. And frankly, both these views have valid criticisms of the way our system has been working, and the complex and nuanced discussion that results both within the movement and outside of the movement is something that's going to be profoundly valuable for sorting out how democracy is going to move forward and get better for the people.
Well, and there's also, can we move over here a little bit? There's cynicism. I'm sure you some think of this as just all very abstract. Mm-hmm. What we now that the rain is falling ever more, I think that I might be of the comfort camp and think, well, I'll get myself out of the environment. But here, Mike, you will stay, and many of these people as well, and we'll keep following you on. Truth is treason in an empire of lies. That's one of the clever signs here.
Yeah.
But I know that there's a lot of issues to deal with, not least of which would be maybe some of the mental health issues of some of the people attracted to this location. But this isn't something you guys can deal with necessarily.
No, there's been a request in the United States media for us to have a clear answer to a variety of problems, and frankly it's not this movement's job to sort out every ill society can offer. Really, it's silly to expect a wide group of people with different perspectives and different level of knowledges to come up to the with perfect solutions for everything that's gone wrong and all the variety of issues that we've seen that we're dealing with. And frankly, that's an invitation for public officials and experts and people with education in a variety of fields to come out and to help us and to look at what sort of things we need to deal with and to sort out the best way to deal with the wide variety of problems that we're facing. More support and a wider variety of people and voices and knowledge is the best way to move this movement forward. And so for the media to accuse us of not having a solution, it's sort of silly because solutions aren't our job. Our job is to make sure everyone's aware of the problem and then to start fostering discussion of what the potential solutions are. And at the moment, we're on the making sure everyone is aware of what the problems are stage, and that's something that I think we're doing a great job of.
Well, and I think so too. Thanks a lot, Mike, for talking to me tonight.
No problem. Thank you very much for taking the time to listen.
Well, so the music is just starting as we leave the square, and the rain is coming down. They've got a music stage set up, kitchens, a media center. It is a nascent form of people managing their own issues. And so far, so good as far as the officialdom here in Victoria goes. It seems pretty relaxed down here, and we'll keep on watching and see what happens at the People's Assembly of Victoria.
And that was a report I did over the weekend. I was remiss earlier in not announcing a public service announcement here for Family History Seminar with internationally acclaimed genealogist Lisa Louise Cook, spelt improperly with an E at the end, I noticed. Be this Saturday, October 29th at 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Vancouver Island Technology Park. Four lectures on genealogical treasures and Google. Lunch is included. Advanced registration is required. For more information, visit www.victoriags.org. I guess that's Genealogical Society. VictoriaGS.org or phone 250-360-2808. And that's again October 29th, Family History Seminar with acclaimed genealogist Lisa Louise Cook. Well, that's all the time I have for this week. I want to thank John Elmer, of course, for coming on again, and Janine Bancroft and Mike there from the People's Assembly. And remind you this lovely autumn evening here in Victoria to stay tuned, especially you jazz fans, because Arnold's coming straight up with Rhythmining to rhythmin' you through this lovely evening here in Victoria. Until the next time.